What an amazing game one. We're breaking down every angle of the Pacers game one win over the Thunder with Tom Haberstroh. And then later on, got Rafael Barlow and James Barlow breaking down a bunch of stuff we're hearing around the NBA about the upcoming draft. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. What an epic game one of the NBA Finals between the Pacers and the Thunder. 111-110 game one win for Indiana. To discuss it with me is Tom Haberstroh. Tom, how you doing? Woo! Woo! Crazy. Unbelievable.
Dude, what just happened? What just happened?
Kev, unbelievable.
What just happened?
Tom, I can't believe it right now, because it felt like throughout most of the game, it felt like OKC should have been up 20 or up 25, and they were up 10, up 15, here or there in the game. Indiana at one point is on pace to have the most turnovers in an NBA Finals game in NBA history. They had 23 entering the fourth quarter. They have only one in the final frame as they make multiple great runs, clawing their way back, before Tyrese Halliburton does it again. He did it again.
He did it again, Kev.
Oh, my goodness.
This is the most mind-boggling run, postseason run, I have ever seen. Like, this team, the Indiana Pacers, were plus 5,000 odds to win the NBA championship this season. Preseason, plus 5,000. And here they are against the team that had the best point differential in NBA history during the regular season. They go into their building, OKC, that has lost one game to the Eastern Conference all season long. And they upset them at the last second. Tyrese Halliburton did it again. This dude, what other dance? What other celly? There's nothing else he can do. It's all done. He's done it all. Tyrese Halliburton is immortal, dude. Immortal.
It feels like Indiana continues to be a team of destiny, right? I mean, like, there's just no other way to put it. This team just continues to have games like this. They're down 15 in the second half to, as you said, one of the greatest regular season teams we've seen, a team that has been dominant throughout their entire postseason run. And in Oklahoma City, they still have the resilience to have a comeback like this with multiple guys coming up clutch. Obviously, Obi Toppin, all the threes he hit throughout the game. Andrew Nembhard, some of the clutch shots, clutch plays he made, real aggressive drives to the basket. Nesmith had a big three late in that second half and the fourth quarter as well. And OKC just kind of collapsed. I mean, like, is there anything you'd pin it on? Like, how do they give this up? How do you give this lead up? Or is this just more Indiana just doing what they've been doing? And as we've been talking about this whole postseason, Tom,
the shot making was insane. The Andrew Nembhard play one-on-one where he crossed up Shai Gilgeous-Alexander on that left wing to get to his left side and hit the three-pointer with 2 minutes left to bring the game within 3 points. That was one of the nastiest plays I have ever seen in the NBA Finals in their building. Like, this is The Obi Toppin threes. Miles Turner didn't play down the stretch because he was so good, and the Thunder went small down the stretch. They wanted to switch. They wanted to be able to guard 1 through 5. And Rick Carlisle, whatever he has imbued in this team, to give them the faith to never let the opponent beat them at any point. They were down. The Pacers were down by 14 points with 8:58 left. They had a 99.1% chance. The Thunder had a 99.1% chance at winning this game, according to Inpredictable.com. Mike Bowie's his algorithm had a 99.1% chance for Oklahoma City Thunder to win game one on their home floor with 8:58 remaining in the fourth quarter. And the Pacers did it again. Tyrese Halliburton was locked up all night long. When he was in the torture chamber, Lou Dort had him in fits. And
amazing,
he gets
gets
that matchup against Cason Wallace in that last second scenario. And I was like, he's going to do it. Lu Dort has had him bottled up the last two seasons. He got freed up in that last second possession, and I was just like, he's going to do it again. And sure enough, he gets that pull up mid range. He held up his follow through. He knew it was going in as soon as he released it. Tyrese Halliburton is incredible. The NBA has gotten a gift from the basketball gods in Tyrese Halliburton, delivering another late game winner. Just unbelievable what we have seen from Tyrese Halliburton this postseason. Done it to every postseason opponent. Milwaukee, the Cavs, the Knicks, and now the Thunder have all been victimized by Tyrese Halliburton's heroics. Unbelievable.
It's crazy that he's had one every single round like this. And I'll tell you what, though, about Halliburton. Hitting that mid-range shot, he used the mid-range for the game winner. He's a 48% shooter on pull-up mid-range jumpers throughout the entire season, regular season and playoffs. Elite number from the mid-range for Halliburton. He's been like that throughout his entire career. Only 13 shots tonight. Sometimes I wish he would do this in the first quarter and in the second quarter and not just the end of games, because we see what he's capable of doing with the shot creation, Tom, when he does put on his aggressive hat. And with him, I still think for Indiana to win this series, you're still going to have a game where Halliburton has 20 plus shots in a game. And he's capable of doing it is my point here, because we saw him do it in the second half. He had a very aggressive third quarter. He hit big shots in the fourth quarter. Halliburton, they win a game one with Halliburton having only 14 points on 13 shots. Halliburton was not at his best in this game, and yet Indiana did exactly what they had to do. They went on the road. They split a game one, and somehow they split a game one despite having 24 turnovers in the game. 24 turnovers in the game. And this is where OKC really lost the game. 24 turnovers. They scored only 11 points off of those turnovers. Only 11 points. That's where the game should have been a blowout for Oklahoma City. They should have been up 25 at certain points in the first half, for that matter. Never mind in the third quarter. But they weren't taking advantage of the opportunities that the Pacers were feeding them when they were sloppy over the course of the whole game. I'm kicking myself if I'm Oklahoma City. I'm pissed off tonight if I'm a Thunder fan, because it's like, how do we not win this game? How?
You think you're going to be pissed off if you're an OKC team?
Here's a stat for you. I don't think I'm sleeping tonight.
Yeah. No, you shouldn't sleep until game two. Like, that's how upsetting this has to be, how devastating this has to be, that they had 14 steals and Indiana had one. And it was like a garbage steal. It was in the backcourt with TJ McConnell swiped. I think it was Andrew Wiggins. No, Aaron Wiggins had him swiped in the backcourt. They didn't have a single steal in OKC's front court the entire game. A plus 13 steal margin in an NBA finals game is usually, I promise you, I looked this up, a plus 12 margin in the steal column in postseason history. Plus 12. 12 or more steals than your opponent. In postseason history, teams are 16-1 now. The one being tonight, OKC has the only loss with a plus 12 margin in the steal column. We've never seen this before. Wow. A team dominate that category by this much. They had 14 steals to Indiana, one. And the margin of victory by the team with the more steals in that, at least 12 more steals than their opponent, the margin of victory entering tonight in postseason history was 19.9 points. That's a 20-point average win margin going into tonight when you have that many more steals than your opponent. What I was thinking in that whole fourth quarter, Kev, was the Ryan Russillo. Is the classic Ryan Russillo line. I'm actually more impressed by the Indiana Pacers in this series. Like, what they did, in this game, if they were going to lose by 5, if they were going to lose by 10, I was going to be more impressed by the Indiana Pacers in this game because of the fact that they kept it within a 3-4 possession game while they were down by 20 turnovers in this game. Kev, that was unreal to see that resilience. But again, this is what the Pacers have done all postseason long.
Something that's interesting to me from watching this entire game, really the thought started before the game, Oklahoma City Thunder head coach Mark Daigneault started Cason Wallace over Isaiah Hartenstein. And this decision was to add more defense, add more speed, add more versatility in Wallace. Wallace in the game finished with a minus 13. Obviously, plus minus is not always indicative of anything, but Haliburton hits the game winner over him. At times early in the game, Siakam was shooting over him as well. In Indiana, Rick Carlisle, when, you know, it's time to win the game late in the fourth quarter, he decides to go small. The Pacers, I think, they would prefer Oklahoma City to be small in this series. So I'm curious, Tom, do you think Daigneault may have been overthinking it going with Wallace in the starting five over Hartenstein, or ultimately was it the right decision? It just didn't pan out with a win in game one.
Yeah, this game wasn't lost by the starting lineup. Like, I don't think that's really what happened here. I think they just choked. I think they choked at down the stretch. And you can argue maybe Hartenstein and Chet Holmgren starting would have gotten this so out of hand that the Pacers would never have a chance to rally back into this game. But that does seem to me like a very surprising move. I went and looked this up, trying to figure out if there's any comp for this. I went back something like 30 years to find a finals champion that switched their game one lineup to something they haven't started all postseason. I couldn't find one. I could not find one. Like, we've had 2017, the Golden State Warriors made a switch in their starting lineup in game one to open up the series, but it was to their normal lineup. Like, in 2014, the San Antonio Spurs, they switched Matt Bonner out, which they finished the Western Conference Finals with, and they put in Tiago Splitter back into the starting lineup for game one. But they had gone to the Splitter lineup all postseason long. It's just they made that switch at the end of the Western Conference Finals. This, I don't know that I've seen an NBA champion, a team that was holding court in the home court advantage, make this kind of panic move. It seems like something that a team that wasn't as dominant as OKC was all season long. I'm not saying they lost the game, but it certainly was uncharacteristic of Mark Daigneault making this move when they had home court advantage. They had the regular season 68 win, number one overall pick, the best point differential in NBA history. And you make that game one switch. It was very questionable, but I wouldn't go as far to say, is that what's cost them the game? It just was a choke down the stretch.
Yeah, I think I'm with you there. I mean, ultimately, I thought it made some sense to go with Hartenstein off the bench instead of in the starting lineup because of Wallace's speed. The matchups made sense on paper. But I would be surprised if he went back to two bigs in game two. However, I do wonder if maybe you'd see more of Chet and Hartenstein on the floor together rather than just staggering them. But ultimately, I do think it was surprising to see it for game one for all the reasons you stated, Tom, because look, it's your game one at home. You're a 68 win team. You rolled through the West except for the 7-game series against Denver. And usually that would be a move you would think you would save for later in the series if necessary, instead going to it in game one. But ultimately, you're right. I think more than anything else, this was just a choke deep in the game. But also, Indiana's defense, it's not like Indiana was struggling defensively throughout the game. OKC in the first half was very inefficient, struggling to create quality looks. Even SGA, it was more volume scoring, not high efficiency scoring. That was true for everybody on that roster, Jalen Williams included. Williams was 6 of 19 in the game. SGA finished 14 of 30, but Chet, 2 of 9. Dort had great shooting night, 5 of 10. Cason Wallace, 3 of 9. Caruso, 3 of 8. A lot of guys weren't getting quality buckets. Indiana's defense, as it has been since really the middle of December, was great again. And so I think in that fourth quarter, Indiana continued to defend well, and they just fixed their turnover issue on offense. They started controlling the ball better, slowed down a little bit as well. They were sped up a bit throughout the game, and only one turnover in the fourth quarter. When you're getting buckets in the half court, that's able to set up your defense as well in half court possession. So I think it was a mixture of choke job by OKC, but also just Indiana continuing to defend at a high level.
Yeah, here's a stat for you. In those 14 live ball turnovers for OKC, they forced 14 live ball turnovers by the Indiana Pacers. They scored 7 points off of them. a 50 offensive rating off of live ball turnovers for Oklahoma City. That is a tourniquet on a wound. Like what Indiana did by making sure that they got back on defense on those turnovers and made sure that they stopped the bleeding was remarkable. What Rick Carlisle has done, again, Nembhard, Pascal Siakam, Obi Toppin, Tyrese Halliburton, Aaron Nesmith, these guys are going down the floor and making sure they do not give up those easy baskets, those easy baskets at the rim. And so when you look at the Indiana Pacers and the way that they're built against OKC is you got to make sure you don't turn the ball over. But if you do, you stop the bleeding on the other end and allowing OKC had a 50 offensive rating off of those live ball turnovers. In the postseason, they had 136 offensive rating. 136, and in this game, it was 50. That's the game right there. They, yes, you can say it's a collapse by Oklahoma City down the stretch, but the fact that they were still in that game, despite having 19 turnovers in the first half, there were 4,280 games, postseason games, since 2000, and we had never seen a team cough up the ball 19 times in the first half. And the reason why they were able to absorb that and able to be rescued from that is because they stopped OKC in transition defense and made sure. I mean, there was that J-Dub dunk late in the game in the fourth quarter where TJ McConnell threw it out of from out of bounds and just threw it away at half court. And J-Dub went down and dunked it. I was like, you know, it is weird. For all the turnovers that they've had, you never really saw a leak out or an easy open layup the other way. And that really tells us the story of the Indiana Pacers, that they never give up and they always come back and recover. And you saw it. Tyrese Halliburton finished the job.
How shocked were you when A.J. Mitchell got some minutes in an NBA Finals game one?
Whoa. Do you think they were playing with their food a little bit? You know, like, it was cool to see. But Kev, like, he was a couple times looked very, very bad in that game. Yeah, there it is. There was a three-pointer, then he forced another shot, and then goes the other way.
What was that? Slow down!
And then Tyrese Halliburton on the other end just gave him a little pump fake, and man, A.J. Mitchell was in the front row, bit on that pump fake.
And that's when Dagnall pulled him. I think A.J. Mitchell knew right away. You could see him kind of hang his head as soon as the whistle was blown for the timeout because he's like, okay, I know. I'm done. I'm out of here after that sequence. I'm out. I'm over. But I was shocked by it. I mean, like, A.J. Mitchell, he played 597 minutes during the regular season, which is a solid amount for a second-round pick on a really deep team. And like, I like A.J. Mitchell at UC Santa Barbara last year. He's a talented playmaker. You know, he's a solid shooter. He's an active player. Definitely saw the energy he brought on the floor. But, man, game one minutes for a rookie who's barely played at all in months. Man, that really shocked me with Dagnall's decision there. For Oklahoma City, Tom, give me a silver lining for the Thunder. They lose game one at home. They blow a 15-point lead. They lose on a game winner. Give me a silver lining for the Thunder.
SGA had his way. He had 38 points, scored 38 on 30 shots. That's actually the sixth most since 2000, the 30 shots in that game, the third most we've seen in a game one since 2000. Allen Iverson had 41 in that game one and went into overtime against the Lakers. That's the sixth guy to have that many shots. And you know, comparing that to Tyrese Halliburton, who was largely absent for most of the game, it was something that you can put down as a victory. Was Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was great. He wasn't living at the free throw line. You know, the efficiency, 38 points on 30 shots. That's not normally where you see Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, but I can't knock a dude who had 38 points in a game. 14 to 30 from the floor, a lot in the mid-range. This is a guy that got to his spots, but man, just they didn't get enough three-point shooting in this game. And the corner three-point shooting on the other end, this is another thing that Indiana has done all postseason long, is they get to their corner threes. OKC, they are willing to give those up, and they made OKC play. So made OKC pay for those. I don't know. It just feels like OKC gave this one away. And you had a 15-point lead there in the second half, a 14-point lead with 8:58 left in the game. they collapsed. They collapsed. And if you're OKC, you have home court again in game two. I picked OKC in five. I did not see this. I'm stunned, Kev. I'm still stunned that Indiana won that game.
Yeah, I'm stunned as well. And I think you mentioned about SGA, you can't knock the guy for 30 shots. I respect Doris Burke. I thought what she said during the broadcast at one point where SGA is being over-aggressive, I thought it was crazy to say that. Like, SGA had to assert himself in this game. His teammate shot 37% in the game. Jalen Williams was not creating quality shots for the most part in the game. Teammates were not hitting shots other than Lou Dort hitting on a heater from three-point range. SGA gave the Thunder what they needed, in my opinion, with his 38 points on 30 shots. He should have and could have more efficient games, but that's what they needed from him in this game to have any chance of winning the game. And they just blew it. They just blew it completely. And you can point a lot of fingers in a lot of different directions there. But I think we've covered a couple different angles with them. For people watching live on YouTube, Eric in the chat brought up an interesting point as well from the Oklahoma City side of things. 53-39 on the glass, Indiana had an advantage. I think this ties back to our earlier conversation when it came to lineups, Tom. Maybe we see a bit more too big moving forward in the series, get more size out there for Oklahoma City with Hartenstein and with Chet Holmgren out there, because you see Siakam 10 rebounds, Nesmith 12 rebounds, Halliburton 10 rebounds in the game, Turner 9. Their center had only 9. Three guys had more than him. Maybe get more size in this game, clean up the boards a bit better on the Oklahoma City side of things. There's little things that they can do, and they almost won this one. But ultimately, man, Indiana did what they had to do. They split. They split, and now, we got a real series here. I picked OKC in five, but I had said before the series, if Indiana splits, anything can happen. If Indiana splits the first two games, this probably goes deeper than just five, because I don't see OKC winning four in a row. I just don't see that. So we get a real series here, and once again, every expert, every analyst, every pundit, everybody's picking OKC in five. They were the heavy favorites, -700 in the series. OKC in five was the most popular bet in this series as well. Once again, is Indiana just being overlooked? And here they are, winning game one again.
Incredible. 15 rebounds in the fourth quarter, 6 rebounds for OKC. 15-6 in the rebound column in the fourth quarter. That was the game for Indiana. And they get 5 offensive rebounds. They had 6 three-pointers, 6-for-10 threes in the fourth quarter for Indiana. OKC in the fourth quarter, 0-for-5 from downtown. They got to the line 13 times compared to Indiana 7, but that margin on the boards and that margin in the three-point column, that was it, man. Like, the shot making from Obi Toppin, the shot making from Tyrese Halliburton and Nembhard. I keep thinking about that one-on-one ISO he had against his countryman, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, with the 2 minutes left. It was so dirty, man. It was such an incredible move. Something that you don't see a guy, he didn't average 20 points a game in the regular season, but in the postseason, he's so much better. He's one of the best playoff risers we've seen in recent NBA history, Andrew Nembhard. And he does it again in this one when they needed a bucket to close it within one possession game with 1:59 left. He takes the MVP off the dribble and just says, check this. It was an incredible shot and just one of the 5 three-pointers that they made, or 6 three-pointers they made in the fourth quarter. Incredible, incredible shot making.
I mean, I think what happened before that shot was Nesmith. So OKC was up 9. Nesmith hit a 3. Then yep. Nembhard hit a step-back 3-pointer, right? And I believe that was the step-back 3 you're referring to right there. Mm-hmm. And then the next play, Dort had the block. He had a block on Nesmith at the rim, and then SGA scored on the other end. And at that point, it was like, okay, OKC took the punch, and they looked like they were about to blow the lead, and now they got it back. They're okay. But Indiana's ability in these games to not just be resilient, their mindset, their approach, but they continue to run their offense late in games. It's so unusual. Like, think about all the clutch teams in NBA history, Tom. The image in your mind is like ISO, pull up jumper from the elbow, pull step back three. It's a lot of slowed down moments in games. And then with Indiana, they just keep running their stuff. That's what they've done in all of these comebacks, is they just run their offense. It's not slow down isolations. It's running their stuff. And I think it's beautiful to watch, man. Like, they are such a fun team that reminds me so much of those beautiful game Spurs. And you know what? Maybe they are the new age beautiful game Spurs, the beautiful game Pacers. And they're going to maybe win a finals behind this style of play where they just – run their stuff in these clutch moments on offense and play defense hard, versatile throughout the game. And here they are, up 1-0, Tom, up 1-0 in the NBA Finals. Anything we missed in this game? Anything else on your mind that we didn't cover with the finals?
Yeah, this isn't lucky for the Indiana Pacers. At some point, you just say, this is part of the script. Like, this is part of what they do. This is part of the blueprint from Rick Carlisle, is the resiliency, the perseverance, the never say die attitude, all the cliches from the movies. This is that team. Like, Rudy has nothing on the Indiana Pacers. This is the craziest comeback underdog story we've seen in a long, long time. The Indiana Pacers, I'm going to say it again, plus 5,000 to win the NBA championship preseason. This would be the most unheard of NBA championship ever. The most unlikely championship ever if Indiana pulls this off. And now they've got potentially three more games at home to do this, to close out the series. And you said it with the playmaking, the passing. This team passes more in this postseason than any postseason we've seen since the 2015 Spurs. In the 2013 Spurs, what we saw was that quintessential summertime. Jackie McMullen did that amazing ESPN The Mag story, talking to Greg Popovich, talking to Tony Parker about that incredible series against the Miami Heat. I was there for that. The way that they just completely demoralize the Heat with their passing surgically. The Indiana Pacers do that too. And they had six assists in that fourth quarter tonight. And the Oklahoma City Thunder had just one. They had six assists on their 12 field goals in the fourth quarter. And OKC had just one assist on their six field goals in that fourth quarter. Just summertime. They play ball like it's summertime. They want you to feel like you're out there as a kid, out on the blacktop and just having fun with your friends and moving the ball the way the game is supposed to be played. They play basketball like it's summertime. The sun is out. It's warm. Everybody's in a good mood. That's how Indiana plays basketball. Everyone touches the ball. And Tyrese Haliburton, although I felt like at times he was too passive and not looking for his own shot, man, he had something up his sleeve and he delivered there at the last second.
Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. Tom, there's other things happening around the NBA right now. So game one of the finals will be on Sunday. Let's talk about some news. On Thursday, we got reports that the Suns could have a surprising suitor for Kevin Durant. John Gambadoro on Arizona Sports 98.7's Burns and Gambo, Suns insider. Gambo is always on top of things with the Suns. Gambo said that the Clippers are an under-the-radar team for Kevin Durant. And so I was thinking about this from the Suns' perspective. Maybe the Clippers could put together the most appealing trade for Kevin Durant. And I played with the trade machine and I came up with a deal, Tom, I want to get your feedback to. Clippers would get Kevin Durant for Norm Powell, Bogdan Bogdanovich, two salaries, Drew Eubanks, Kobe Brown, and the number 30 pick. If that's the type of deal the Clippers could put together for the Phoenix Suns, do you think that's an acceptable deal for the Suns, or should they be expecting more somewhere out there in return for KD, who's in his late 30s, has only 1 year remaining on his deal, is not quite in his prime anymore?
if you trade Kevin Durant for Norm Powell, I'm sorry. Like, that's not the return I'm looking for.
And the number 30 pick, Tom.
Kev, you know this draft as well as anybody. Is the number 30 pick, with all the NIL deals we're seeing right now to bring back end of first round talent, is that really a 30 pick, or is that like a 45 pick?
No, I think it's like a 30 pick. I do. I do feel that way. I think a lot of the guys that went back were, you know, after 30, if that makes any sense. But what do you expect for KD is my underlying point here. Are you really going to get a lot for him at his age, with his injury history, with 1 year remaining on his contract? Is a sixth man of the year quality guy in Norm Powell, another quality rotation guy, Bogdanovich, and a first round pick, possibly the best that's out there for the Suns? Or in this case, the Clippers can deal their 2031 first as well. If they had to give more, they do have that as an option. They could add second round picks as well. There's other ways you can go about this. You could give Derek Jones Jr. instead of Drew Eubanks and Kobe Brown. There's different configurations for the Clippers, but do you see this as a viable path, or are you just thinking, no, there's nothing the Clippers can put out there that would make sense for them to go get Kevin Durant? KD goes somewhere else.
Yeah, I would imagine he goes somewhere else if that's the offer that the Clippers are going to put in. But again, if the Clippers are a dark horse suitor for Kevin Durant, you're not going to put in Zubats into the deal. You're not going to put Kawhi Leonard into the deal. So like, it's going to have to be something like this. And I don't see Matt Ishbia and Brian Gregory signing off on something like this. I'd imagine they could get something more from, say, Minnesota. But then again, if Minnesota's like, hey, we can offer you Nikhil Alexander, well, they can't, unless it's some sort of sign and trade, but like Julius Randle, I don't know if that gets you anywhere. Julius Randle being an expiring deal, is that something you want? Or Norm Powell being an expiring deal at $20 million next season, maybe that's something you can, you know, hang your hat on and say, look, we got a good player. He's a veteran player, 31 years old on the back half of his career, but we got a first round pick for Kevin Durant. Can you get more from somewhere else? I'd imagine you could. I'd be surprised if that is the best deal you could get for Kevin Durant, even though, you know, he is at this age where I don't know if you can guarantee that Kevin Durant is going to be healthy for a full postseason run. The Clippers are not built for the 16 wins that you need to win an NBA championship. Does Kevin Durant help you there? We saw what happened with James Harden and Kyrie Irving a few years ago. I don't think it's any more likely that you win a championship than that team a couple years ago, and they broke down as well.
Well, KD's going to be 37 next year, and with him, I could see, you know, the Knicks, Shams Charania reported how they made an offer for KD at the deadline this year. Minnesota, as you said, also made an offer. Anthony Edwards and KD have a very close relationship. The Rockets perhaps could have interest in Kevin Durant as well. And if they wanted to put a stronger offer out there, they definitely could do that. And there could always be surprising teams as well. I don't think you can rule out a team coming out of nowhere and saying, you know what, screw it. We'll go get KD for 1 year and try to win a hell of a lot of games, put with an offer that puts them over the top of anybody else. So I think there's other teams that could offer more for Kevin Durant, but I am intrigued by the Clippers as kind of a team, because if they did put their 2031 first up on the table for him, unprotected, if they were willing to do that, that would be a high-value asset considering how old that team is. That would be a valuable choice for them. So for the Suns, they're dealing with the KD stuff. They just hired their head coach, Jordan Ott, who is a Cavaliers assistant head coach. The Phoenix Suns have hired him as their new head coach. No surprise here. Jordan Ott went to Michigan State.
The Phoenix Spartans. This is Phoenix.
It's happening.
I've never seen anything like this, man. We talked about it on The Big Number this week with Dan Devine. In Charlotte, we had Michael Jordan hiring Buzz Peterson, his college roommate at Chapel Hill, and then Mitch Kupchak, also Chapel Hill. But it's not like they hired George Karl, you know? It's not like they hired Hubert Davis to run the team. This is all three levels. The owner, the GM, and the head coach all went to Michigan State and all played under or coached under Tom Izzo. like, man, when they released the names of the candidates, I was like, who are we kidding here? Jordan Ott's going to get the job. He went to Michigan State, game over. And, you know, this guy, Brian Gregory, he's a college coach. He's been a former head coach at college. But, like, to hire this guy as your top executive, I mean, it is one way to do it. And his press conference was, all he talked about was alignment, on the same page. We're aligned, all aligned. In other words, Matt Ishbia, take the reins, take the steering wheel. It's your organization. Go run the team how you want it. And he made an email to his, he wrote an email, a memo to his organization. And he was basically like, I did things by the book. I did things the traditional, the conventional way as an owner. And I hired experts, and now it's time for me to step in and throw my influence in, around here a little bit more. I'm not happy with the results. When has that ever worked, Kev? When has the owner coming in and meddling in all those decisions, when has that ever worked in the NBA?
Well, let me read you exactly what he said, Tom, because I just think it's fascinating. Oh, it's just so fascinating. He said, let me start with the most important point. The Phoenix Suns will do things very differently than most other NBA franchises. I will be extremely active in the decisions and management of this organization on and off the floor. While I won't be reviewing film, designing offenses, or running the draft room, I will be deeply involved in ensuring the basketball organizations, like every other area of our organization, is performing at the highest level. I'm aware that this approach is different than most other organizations. I'm not the conventional NBA owner, and I don't want to be. And that's where he got into what you were saying. I'm not, I've tried the conventional playbook, you know, this and that. Dude, you weren't hands-on before, like pushing for the KD deal, saying, okay, we'll give it all. We'll give all the picks. We'll give Bridges. We'll give everything. You weren't hands-on before? What does that mean with what we're about to see? What does it mean?
Devin Booker, blink twice if you need to be rescued. Okay. Like, if you're Devin Booker watching this organization be run by this alma mater of Michigan State, I want out. If I'm Devin Booker and hearing these quotes from my owners saying, like, I need to be more. What does Matt Ishbia know what it's like to run an NBA team as a head coach or as a GM? He's saying he's not going to be making the decisions in the draft room or not being making the decisions in X's and O's. But you hire two people who you were boys with from Michigan State to run your team. It seems like you are going to be at the helm. And if I'm Devin Booker, I want out. That does not seem like a professional organization. And given the fact that, you know, he's saying, I'm going to do things differently. Different isn't always good. That is not always a good thing, to run things completely antithetical to how, like, look at Sam Presti and how he's run that organization in OKC. Look at how Kevin Pritchard over in Indiana. Like, it's not like they're just hiring cronies left and right to make sure that they're run in the same way. It is a very, you know, I don't think any NBA fan could even name who the owners, if they had the picture up, who the owners of OKC or Indiana are. Like, I just don't think that he's doing this the right way. And I'd be afraid that you're going to scare away the guy, the only star there that has been there since day one, Devin Booker, by the way he's running this.
I'll tell you what, Tom, I'm a little surprised that that stuff isn't more out there with Book. He's 28 years old right now. He turns 29 in October during the early part of the season. Still in the prime of his career, but about to turn 30. Hasn't won a championship yet. A ton of teams that are contenders would want Devin Booker if he decided to ask out. A ton of teams would want Devin Booker. And so I'm a little bit surprised that there just hasn't been more, you know, scuttlebutt about that or more real noise, whatever it is. I'm just surprised we haven't gotten there yet when we're already talking about a team, Kevin Durant being traded possibly this summer. In all likelihood, KD gets traded. We're talking about the Suns figuring out ways to get rid of Bradley Beal, how they don't want him back, talking about, you know, waiving him or finding some type of trade partner for him. They don't want Beal back. And then Booker, like, you're there alone on the island, Tom Hanks, Castaway style. It's just like, there's nothing there with you. Is it really that important to be a lifer there? Maybe it is. Maybe it is that important to him that he wants to be a lifer in Phoenix. Maybe he loves living life in Arizona and that's where he wants to be. That's very possible. And, you know, all respect to him if that's what he wants in his life. But so many players, especially everything I know about Book, that drive to win a championship, I don't see the path for Phoenix right now, man. I just don't see the path. And that's why I'm surprised and we just don't see that stuff out there with him.
Is there a Michigan State guy on the Knicks? I'm just trying to figure this out. So we know that Karl-Anthony Towns and Devin Booker want to play together. And I said before the season, like, if the Phoenix Suns just spontaneously combust this season, that you could see Leon Rose, who they did. It didn't actually happen, but the time is still there. Like, there's time hasn't completely run out on this theory that the Knicks will try to do everything they can to get a guy like Devin Booker on the team, especially when Karl Towns, also a CAA guy, they want Karl Towns. They want to get him happy and making sure they can build a great offense around him, and they let Tom Thibodeau go. Is there a scenario in which the New York Knicks get on the phone with Brian Gregory and say, how do we get Devin Booker here? If you're already willing to trade Kevin Durant to the Los Angeles Clippers, and let's say Devin Booker figures out a way to make a trade request, a soft one, so it doesn't make him look like the bad guy, maybe you do a deal for Mikal Bridges and bring him
home. There's nothing Book can do that makes him look like the bad guy. I think Suns fans would support Book, you know, in his desire to leave. I think they would say, we get it. We get it. We understand why you want to leave. I don't think there's any world in which Book would end up looking like the bad guy here. The one thing I will say, Tom, is I don't think the Knicks have the assets to go get Book. If Booker did ask out, I just don't see the path for the Knicks. Even if he were to say, I want to go to New York. I don't think that the Suns are going to take whatever scraps the Knicks can give from their leftover pile of assets after trading 6 picks for Bridges, after going to get Karl-Anthony Towns. I just don't see that. Booker has 3 years remaining on his contract. To me, the team that makes the most sense to go get him is actually the Houston Rockets. Everybody talks about KD for the Rockets, but to me, Booker is the guy that makes total sense for that Rockets roster, for where they are with as a team, what they're missing with his playmaking and scoring and shooting ability, his versatility on ball and off ball. Booker would be perfect for Houston to go actually cash in on some of their own assets and give Phoenix back some of their own picks. And I do wonder, though, you know, if the Suns are trading KD, and if they're trying to get rid of Beal, and if all they really have left is Book and a bunch of young guys, maybe you continue trying to build as a young team, but maybe you just go all the way in on a rebuild, getting back a lot of your picks, especially next year, in what is a loaded draft in 2026 at the top with multiple guys that are of Cooper Flag quality. Darren Peterson at Kansas, AJ DeBonta at BYU, Boozer at Duke, among others in that draft class that are number one pick quality. Maybe that is a path you would thinking about going if you're the Phoenix Suns. Hey, I mean, look, Shams and Windhorst and all these plugged-in insiders have said how it's going to be an explosive summer. Hey, maybe you expect the unexpected with some of the guys that could become available.
I mean, isn't the writing on the wall here? I mean, I know Phoenix fans will say there's no way Devin Booker is going to ask out of this situation, but like,
yeah, why not?
The Bradley Beal no trade clause, that was the first wild card for them. And then you switch a coach for 3 straight seasons. First you have Frank Vogel, and then you have Mike Budenholzer, and now you bring in a first-time head coach that went to the same alma mater as your new GM, who's never been a GM before and is a longtime college coach under Tom Izzo. This seems to me like in any other normal circumstance, you're looking at this as a third party, an independent party, and saying, how is Devin Booker happy with this? This doesn't seem like a serious organization, Kev.
Yeah, I mean, hey, we'll see. We'll see what they end up doing with Kevin Durant. That's really the first domino here. And then from there, Tom, who knows? We have a whole offseason ahead of us, draft around the corner. I talked with Raphael and James Barlow about the NBA draft later on this podcast. And Tom, we have whole NBA finals ahead of us as well after the Pacers game one win. I still can't believe it. I still can't believe it.
Yo,
Tom,
do you remember this stat I did real quick? Stat I did earlier this postseason was that Tyrese Halliburton was 12 of 14 in shots to tie or go ahead in the final 2 minutes of the game this postseason. 12 of 14. And he just added another one tonight. I mean, think about that. 12 of 14 in fourth quarter, final 120 seconds to tie or go ahead. And he hit another one. Like a movie script. If someone wrote the script on this Indiana Pacers and handed it to some executive in a studio, they'd laugh it off and say, this is not possible. This is not realistic. What Tyrese Halliburton is doing this postseason, Indiana Pacers are doing this against OKC that won 68 games and went 35-1 against the Eastern Conference this season. No way that's possible. And yet here they are up 1-0 in the NBA finals. I mean, and you know what? His pops was there to see it. His pops was so on the cool. road there to see it. Just what a story, man. This is so cool. We needed this. The NBA needed Tyrese Halliburton to be the villain, and he is doing that to a T. I love it.
Tom, thanks for joining me, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kev.
All right, coming up next, we're talking NBA draft with James Barlow and Rafael Barlow. Talking about a lot of the stuff happening around the NBA right now. A lot of interesting things happening. That's coming up right now. All right, now joining me, Rafael and James Barlow from NBA Draft Big Board. You can find their Substack. Rafael, James, how you guys doing today?
Good, man. Good to be on again. It's been, I guess, just a few weeks. I saw you in Chicago.
I know. It hasn't been long. James, we only had two chairs in the hotel room.
Man, I'm good. I can set screens. I can run the offense. Whatever you need me to do, man. I appreciate you having me on, though.
Well, let's start out with some of the latest intel happening around the NBA right now. Rafael earlier this week reported that the Sixers, with what they could do with the number three pick, they're looking around. Kaman Malawach out of Duke is in consideration there. Trey Johnson out of Texas. James, what's your initial reaction to what Philly's thinking about at the number three pick?
I know what I would do if I were Philly. I would go with Ace. I understand Malawach at three. You need insurance from B because he's got a shot clock on how many games he could play. I do like Trey Johnson a lot, but I think that with Ace Bailey's size, it may just be a better fit in terms of like what they have going on with wing depth. I know Quentin Grimes is due to get paid, and I know Kelly Oubre, I think he has a player option. So I think Ace Bailey, not scaled down from like trying to be a scorer into a shooter, he fits what they want to do long term. You get 6'8", 6'9", however tall he is in shoes. On the wing. I think that's a better fit for him, but I understand both sides as far as like Trey Johnson and Malawach.
Rafael, is Philly thinking that Ace Bailey can't scale down and that's why they could be looking around here with different options at three?
I don't know what Philly's thinking, to be honest with you. I get that they're in a weird situation just because they have two guys that you have to assume they're in win now mode, right? I mean, they just paid Embiid a lot of money. They just paid Paul George a lot of money. You do need insurance for Embiid, so I understand that. And if you believe Molly Welch is going to be a starting caliber center and a star down the line, then you have to kick the tires on that. But I can't put a finger on what they're thinking. I know what I would do if I were Daryl Morey. I would go with Trey Johnson. But it's
Why would you go with Trey?
Just when I look at what he did his freshman year at Texas, SEC was historically the best conference as far as just teams in the tournament. He led the SEC in scoring, shot 39% from three on a heavy, heavy volume of contested shots. And so with him, you get a score, you get a guy that I think he's a better passer than Ace Bailey. He's a better shooter than Ace Bailey, a little smaller. The height difference is not what we thought it was. And I think he's, like I said, I don't know if I mentioned, but a better passer. I just think he's a better overall player than Ace Bailey.
James, you say Ace. Like, do you think Trey Johnson will be a bad idea for Philly? Because personally, I think Trey would make a lot of sense for the Sixers in the regard that, like, he adds a ton of shooting, adds more firepower in the backcourt. But then I looked, I have Jared McCain. They have Tyrese Maxey. Is it too much overlap in the backcourt would be my question when Trey Johnson there's. If it's like, what do you think about that idea?
I'm all for firepower, but I just feel like Ace's defensive upside is a little bit higher. I mean, he is bigger. He was more active on the glass. He should be able to block shots in the weak side. And I think that the trade-off is, okay, maybe we're not getting somebody who can – we're still getting a very good scorer. I mean, like Ace Bailey played extremely well at Rutgers. It's just that in a scaled-down role, if he's like that Michael Porter Jr. type player who can make open shots and defend and rebound, I think that more so is what they need, especially since like their timeline is right now. Now, if Ace turns into something else, then you still could be getting a high-level, you know, score. It's just that right now, two-year window, really a one-year window, I think they might need Simple, and then they can still develop him into something later on down the line.
Is MPJ a fair comp, though, for Ace Bailey? I mean, MPJ had a flamethrower jumper in high school, flamethrower in college. He's a 40% guy on a high volume in his career. Ace Bailey hasn't had numbers at that level. He's also been, like, up and down from the free throw line, for that matter. Are we sure Ace Bailey actually is an elite shooter?
That's a fair question. I believe he was at, like, what we would say league average. Raf is over here smirking. Is that league average even in high school from three? But I also think that some of that is the type of shots that he's taking. So, like, in high school, there are a lot of stare-down threes. And even at Rutgers, there still are a lot of stare-down threes. You're going to have to reprogram him. But if you reprogram him, he should be I think, even though the free throw percentage could go either way, if he's a 37% three-point shooter at 6'8", 6'9", like, you'll absolutely take that.
Raf, you were smirking.
I just think that he's very, very streaky. And when he's on, he's incredible. But I don't know if he's a consistent shooter. And like you said, the free throw shooting. He hasn't been like a phenomenal free throw shooter either. So when I look at Trey Johnson, the 39% from three, 87% from the foul line, to me that says, all right, the shooting numbers are real. I just don't know how real they are with Ace Bailey.
Yeah, I have my concerns there with him, too. I mean, like, I'm not the biggest Ace Bailey guy. Personally, if I'm Philadelphia, I'd be very, very open to trading down. I've heard the Pelicans at number 7 like Ace Bailey. Joe Dumars there sounds like he really and likes Ace Bailey, could try to trade up to number 3 to Philly or number 4 with Charlotte. That, to me, is the best-case scenario for the Sixers, is you trade down 4 spots from 3 to 7. New Orleans gets their guy in Ace Bailey. And then at number 7, you can probably still get Malawach there. I would imagine he's going to still be there. I don't know if Trey Johnson would be there at number 7 for Philadelphia. But Malawach, like, I don't see it. Correct me if I'm wrong, Raphael, but like, I don't think he'd be going 4 or 5.
I don't know. If I'm Charlotte, I have to really consider it. I mean, you can't bring Mark Williams back after you traded him. And no. Then he has to come back. Then he posted something after was it the Lakers loss or something like that. I just think that relationship is probably damaged. And if Molly Welch can provide what Mark Williams provided, but he's healthier and he's cheaper and younger, to me that makes some sense there. Because if you let Mark go this summer, then who do you have at the 5? Are you playing Nurkic at the 5 next year?
No.
Yeah,
he's done. Soon he'll be looking international at some point. It's just the reality of it. Like, he's near the end after a really strong career. But I think that's a good point about Charlotte at number 4. I think with them, like, definitely looking for a big, even Derek Queen, if they were to trade down, would be interesting for them. With Jeremiah Fears, guard out of Oklahoma, you wrote earlier in the week that he could be moving into the top 5. Are we talking 4, you know, Charlotte, backcourt with LaMelo? Are we talking Utah? Danny Ainge has always fancied, you know, guards in the mold of Jeremiah Fears, these spark plugs, smaller scoring guards. What are you hearing with Jeremiah Fears' rise, Raphael?
I heard there's some teams that really like him, and there are some teams that feel like they would probably have to move up to get him. So Brooklyn is a team that I've heard that probably has some interest there. And so I've also heard from scouts from other teams that say that their scouting staff believes that he could be a better long-term prospect than Dylan Harper, as far as just being like an exciting lead guard. And they talked about him being younger, and just what he did at Oklahoma was more impressive than what Dylan Harper did at Rutgers. So I think Dylan Harper is the consensus at number two, but I've heard there's some teams that the gap is not that big between those two guys.
Is that a crazy thought for teams, James?
For team, I said that he was a top five pick in December, so I don't think it's a crazy thought. I feel like,
could he be better than Dylan Harper? Could Jeremiah Fears be better than Dylan Harper in the long term?
I think he could be better in the long term. Again, you ask yourself, what does Dylan Harper do better? Obviously, he finishes better at the rim. He's something like 65%, and he's bigger. But as far as like playmaking and the shooting numbers, they weren't, as far as like their high school to their college level, weren't too far off. And again, like Raphael said, Oklahoma has maybe one NBA player on that team besides him. And it was a historically great conference in the SEC, and they pushed UConn. They gave UConn everything. He was an engine. I talked to a college coach in the SEC, and he was like, he was one of our toughest matchups because he's hard to keep out of the paint. And then you factor in that he's 18. Like, he did all that, and he should just now be preparing for his freshman year of college. So I can see it, but, I mean, personally, I still think Dylan Harper is the second best prospect. I do think that. While he, you know, had his concerns at Rutgers as far as the jump shot, and maybe you say, well, how does a team that features another NBA top five pick only win X amount of games? But I do think that long term he is going to be really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, I think Harper's, you know, obviously the at-rim finishing's awesome. He's so fluid in the lane, herky-jerky stuff. You know, he's manipulative with his moves on the basket. He's just strong. He's big, like you said. But with Fears, like, if you're comparing the shooting upside of Harper to the shooting upside of Fears, you know, you look at Harper at Rutgers his freshman year. He shot 36.8% on catch-and-shoot threes, 29.2% on pull-up threes, 27.8% on pull-up twos, 76.2% from the free throw line. And then with Fears, you know, the 3-point percentage on the surface was not good, 28%, but he was only 20.5% on dribble jumper threes, 36.1% on catch and shoot threes, 43.3% on mid-range jumpers, 50% on floaters, 85% from the free throw line. There's more good, you know, touch indicators for Fears at the college and high school level than there are for Harper. Raphael, I think with Harper, I think he's a great prospect, but I've heard people say generational. I can't get there calling Dylan Harper a generational prospect without feeling confident in him being a long-term shooting prospect. That's my feeling. Are you with me, or am I underrating the shooting upside?
Well, the word generational, it's just been used too loosely the last few years.
It's
way too much. I think for Harper, if he can just improve as a mid-range shooter, because he was good off the catch, I just think for him it's being a better mid-range shooter. Coming into the year, I thought he would struggle as a mid-range shooter because of the low release. Now, I know like James Harden doesn't have the highest release. I know Trae Young and Tyrese Maxey don't have necessarily the highest release. But I felt like with Harper, when he was shooting the mid-range shot, because his release is so low, it can turn what looks like an open jumper into a contested jumper. And I wonder, with NBA length, it's just that little bit of space. Is that going to make it harder for him? But if he can improve as a mid-range shooter, I think for him, because of his size and teams are running multiple ball handler lineups, I think teams may see that he's more valuable off the ball too.
Raphael, this got aggregated earlier in the week. The father of a projected lottery pick told me the Bucks have been doing background work on his son. Was that father Ron Harper? Did he just tweet it out?
It wasn't Ron Harper. I could tell you that much. It was not Ron Harper. He started getting tagged, and then he had to reply. I woke up at like 2 o'clock in the morning. I got on Facebook, and it's like some site – that was the first thing that popped up on my Facebook feed, and everybody's going after Ron Harper. So if I see Ron at the draft, I'm going to apologize because everybody's thinking it was him.
Who was it, James?
Something with the connection, man. I don't know. Something wrong with my internet right now.
Oh, I'm lagging. I'm skipping around.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I think on one hand, teams do their due diligence,
yes.
Right? Like teams dig around, right? On the other hand, you do your due diligence mostly in the range that you think you might be drafting. Yeah. Right. Like, that's just the reality of it. And so, like, I understand the people that, like, are getting crazy about it. Like, ooh, this could mean trade. But I also understand the people that are like, this is a nothing burger. Like, yeah. Rafael, where do you kind of, like, what's your assessment of your own report when it comes to, like, what could this mean for the Bucks and what they do with Giannis or even, you know, something else, you know, moving up in the drafts?
Yeah, it's just their due diligence. I mean, if Giannis says, I want to be moved, they're going to move him more than likely for a team that's probably selecting high in this draft. I couldn't imagine him wanting to go to, I don't know. I mean, just some of those situations make a little bit of sense. If it's Houston, they have a top 10 pick. If it's Brooklyn, which to me doesn't make any sense at all, other than maybe he wants to live in New York, they have the eighth pick. So I just think they're doing their due diligence, which they're supposed to do, because they're in limbo right now. They have no idea. I mean, maybe they do have an idea, but I mean, they are basically a phone call away from having to shop him, and you have a small time to make it happen.
Hey, here's the thing, though, right? Like, I think from Giannis's perspective, you know, Houston would make sense, but from Milwaukee's perspective, all that makes sense to me is getting the best offer. That's it. I don't care if it's Charlotte. I don't care if it's Utah. I don't care who it is. I'm taking the best offer. And I don't know if that's harsh to say, considering the career Giannis has had in Milwaukee. But like, you got to do what's best for your franchise. And you've already gone all in around him. You've done everything possible. You want a title. You've traded future assets to maximize the team around him. And obviously, it's fallen off in recent years because John Horst has whiffed on so many draft picks in the middle of the draft. But ultimately, you gotta, for your fans and for your future of your franchise and all the players that you would have moving forward, you just gotta take the best deal. So, like, if some surprising team came out of nowhere and traded all their future picks for Giannis, like, that's what you gotta take. Is there, James, like, when you, what's your assessment of that Giannis situation and what the Bucks should be targeting in a return for him?
If I'm Milwaukee, I'm calling San Antonio and I'm like, I need number two and I need Castle and I need something else in the future. I feel like with two,
so both guards,
yeah, I need both of them because, you know, this is the start of basically a new franchise in a sense because of what Giannis means to Milwaukee. So if I can get two guys, especially with Castle, I mean, that was rookie of the year last year, and the number two pick, we can build towards a future because, like you said, they don't have anybody, and you have to start something. You have to give, you know, fans a reason to want to show up. So San Antonio would be the first team that I would call. I get Brooklyn in a sense, but like Rob said, like with Brooklyn, they don't have anything to, you know, like they have picks. So again, unless you just want to live in Brooklyn and play there, it doesn't make sense as a basketball standpoint. But I also think that Houston, though, it's a tough fit because of what you would have to probably give up to get Giannis. But, you know, like that Giannis needs spacing. And you're talking about a really good defensive team still. But, like, who do you have to play around him that you wouldn't have to give up? So if it's me and I'm Milwaukee, it's San Antonio. And even if I'm Giannis, I'm like, send me to San Antonio. I get to play at Wemby. Wemby gets to shoot his threes. And then it's like, good luck trying to score on those two, you know, in the paint. Mm.
Man, dude, the big pick and roll,
yeah,
between Giannis and Wemby with either of them as the ball handler or the screener, would be crazy, right?
Yeah. I mean, the lineup would be crazy. I mean, there could be some spacing issue. You'd have to fill out the rest of the starting lineup with guys that can shoot. If I'm Giannis, I don't know if I want to go to the West with Boston possibly being down or just the luxury tax and Jason Tatum's injury. I might want to stay out in the East.
I'd rather stay in the East too if I'm him. Like he's openly talked about the desire to win a second championship. I'm paraphrasing here, but I think he said himself, I'd consider it a failure if I don't win a second championship. So like you're like, dude, the West is just so loaded. There's going to be a good team or multiple good teams that miss the playoffs in the Western Conference, whereas in the East there's going to be multiple bad teams that make the playoffs. It's just the reality of it, your chances are far better. Boston last year, their road to the East to the finals was a hell of a lot easier than it was in the West for Dallas. And then just like this year with Indiana, the path was easier. Not to diminish it, the path is just easier in the Eastern Conference than it was for Oklahoma City. So I think for Giannis, that's where things get interesting because, you know, Windhorst reporting on Toronto looking for a big fish. I think there's I think there's two things behind that. I think Toronto, A, like they are open to trying to make a big move, but B, like Masai Ujiri is under so much pressure right now to progress that team forward. I think this is like appeasing ownership as well, like showing like, hey, we're going for it, we're trying. So I think there's two sides of it there with Toronto. But in general, though, I think some of these teams at the bottom of the conference in the East, whether it's Philly with number three, or like the less obvious teams like Charlotte, like who's to say you can't go out and trade for two guys and package them around LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller, and you know, maybe you keep Miles Bridges in the deal. Like you go get a big and you go get a scoring wing. Like suddenly you could be a 50 win team in the Eastern Conference. Like I don't think a turnaround like that is that crazy when we just saw the Pistons get better after adding Tobias Harris and Malik Beasley.
Yeah.
You know, like the turnaround's going to happen really fast in the Eastern Conference, going from, you know, bottom of the barrel to being a really good playoff team and maybe even a contender. So I don't know, man, like that's where like with your report about a father talking about the Bucks sniffing around, that's where I'm thinking like, it doesn't have to be San Antonio. It could be a team lower than that where things get really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And with Charlotte, I just think health. They were, weren't they a playoff team recently, a couple years ago? Or they play in or something
they were,
like
they
that?
They were like on the verge. Like they were really close. Yes, and, exactly.
And LaMelo's been banged up, you know, his whole career. So I think if you can get him to play 70 games, I mean, you got to figure Mark Williams hasn't played a lot of games. I think they're a team that, I mean, they got some – I think this new ownership group has made some changes, but they just need to be healthy, and I think they could be in that mix.
They were a 43-39 team during the 21-22 season, and they missed the playoffs that year. But that season, LaMelo played 75 games. Bridges played 80 games. They had Gordon Hayward that year. He played 49 games. PJ Washington, 65 games. So pretty healthy that season. Do you think it would be insane for Charlotte to go that route, James?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. But again, if I am Milwaukee, like you're giving me the fourth pick and who else? I need Brandon Miller.
Future picks. A bunch of future picks.
Because they don't have any picks. They don't own the rights to their own picks for, what, 2031 or something like that?
Yeah.
So they
Milwaukee,
need picks.
Milwaukee, you mean.
Yes, Milwaukee, yes.
Yeah, Charlotte makes sense. I've seen on Twitter, I don't know how realistic it is. I don't know, they don't have any picks, but Giannis in Atlanta would be interesting. Considering, you know, Atlanta is one of those teams that's like they're close, at least to a play-in team all the time. And obviously Giannis pushed them over the top, but I don't believe they control their future as well. So it'd have to be like Ricochet and probably Jalen Johnson. But again, if I'm Milwaukee, like I really can't. Good players, but can you sell your fan base on those two guys?
Well that's the thing. It's like, do you want the mystery box of draft picks if you're the Bucks?
Yeah.
Or do you want players that you've seen in the NBA and that you believe in? Like, it makes me think about like totally different circumstances. But when the Spurs traded Kawhi Leonard to the Raptors, they end up trading for DeMar DeRozan. Mm-hmm. And for them, they wanted a proven guy. That's what they wanted. like it or not, they'd rather have DeMar DeRozan than they did Jaylen Brown from Boston, a less proven player at the time. And so for the Bucks, in a situation, everybody's talking about picks. And I do think they'll go for picks. I think that's the sensible thing to do. But you could see them say, well, maybe we want, you know, a few less picks and players as well, and worry less about the draft picks. So I think that's a real possibility. But ultimately, I if I'm a Bucks fan, like, I want the picks. Like, just give me the draft picks.
You know why? I think that could be a possibility. I mean, I read Giannis's book. He thought he was going to Atlanta the whole time. I think he stayed at Danny Ferry's house, and then the Bucks end up selecting him. I've seen the rumors that his agent is interviewing for the Hawks general manager or basketball operations job. Jalen Johnson is from Milwaukee. I mean, there might be some smoke there.
Is that true about Giannis's agent? I haven't seen that.
Yeah, Mark Stein reported it. It's the same agent that represents Giannis and Bam.
Alex from Octagon. Wow. Yes. Okay, yeah, I see it now from 3 weeks ago. I must have missed that 3 weeks ago. Ah, That's interesting. And Alex has been there from the beginning with Giannis.
Yes, yes. And that's in Giannis's book. It was written by Marin Fader. I think I have it in my background. Giannis came to the States.
Me too, right over my shoulder, somewhere over
here. Great book. Yeah, great book. Awesome. I actually talked to Giannis about it. That's a whole different story.
Did Giannis like the book?
No, he did not.
New York Times bestseller.
Yes. But he
didn't like it. What was his cartoon movie or something made about his life? It's self-produced, it's like always what you like. When it's stuff you're reporting on that you don't have your hands on, of course.
Yeah, he did. Like it was funny because I saw him after a Mavs game, and he walked by and said, "Hey, man, I enjoyed your book." And he was just so passionate. And I had my son with me. My son is 2 years old. He goes to games with me, but the way Giannis was just passionate about it, my son was a little scared. He started hiding behind my leg. Giannis wasn't screaming or anything like that, but he just said that he didn't really know much about the book, and it just came out a few days after he won a championship and so on. So I don't know if he wanted to have a bigger role in it, but he just wasn't too happy about it.
I don't think he had any role. I think Mirren reported that book on her own, and she reported the hell out of it. There's so many great stories in that book. But that's interesting about I had not seen that Stein report from 3 weeks ago with Giannis's agent interviewing for that Hawks position, because they still haven't hired anybody for that.
Yeah.
There's still no clarity exactly on what they're going to do with that position. When I texted you guys about coming on the show this week, I asked, like, is there anything you want to talk about? And James, you mentioned Noah Esenge. Why do you want to talk about Noah Esenge?
He's in a good spot right now in the sense that everybody else is done playing right now. And he has a whole opportunity to keep doing things. He had a 24-12 game a few days ago. And me and Rafi got a chance to see him in Dubai. And he's playing almost exactly the same way. Just hard play finisher, fingerprints all over the game, rebounds. He pushes the ball in transition. He plays the passing lanes. He's an very interesting prospect, considering that he's 18 and he just barely made the cutoff to be drafted this year. And I think he has a lot of upside. I think he had, a 20-point game against Portland in a preseason game. And it's just a matter of trying to figure out, how do you harness all this ability? And I also think that it helps that Pascal Siakam is playing in the finals. And Pascal has a similar energy guy now. Again, he turned into a playmaking four, but maybe that's what Esenge could be long-term. But I think he's in a good spot. He's got fresh film and he's playing well.
Ulm's in the middle of the playoffs right now. He had 22-14 in game one. Game two, not quite as good. 7 points on 2 of 5 with 8 boards. But the 8 boards, Rafael, he always seems to impact the game beyond scoring, right, with Esenge. Like, it's not just about scoring with him. That's, what could turn him into something special. But he impacts the game in so many different categories. How would you describe Esenge to somebody who has never watched him play?
So my comparison for him is like a combination of Sean Marion and Tayshaun Prince. Marion can get you 15 to 17 points per game without a single play ran for him. And James and I, we saw him in Dubai, I think it was last spring. He had 33 points and 17 rebounds. I don't even think he hit a single jumper that game.
He missed eight free throws too.
Yeah, it was just energy, rebounds, timely cuts, transition finishes, steals. It was just, he was super energetic. And then when I watched him play against Portland in the preseason, yes, Portland didn't have their full lineup, but the fact that he was 17 at the time in the NBA arena, he was still productive. I think the sky's the limit for him. And I think defensively, maybe he can be like Tayshaun Prince, just this long, swishy defender that can guard 1 through 4. Him being thin could help as far as him chasing guys off screens and around screens. So I really like him. And just what I saw based off the first playoff game, it made me think of Bilal Coulibaly a couple years ago, who just saw his draft stock skyrocket because he was playing in the playoffs. Everybody else had been home for a month, and then he was number 7 or 6 or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I think Esenge could end up being in that range also.
Why is he not top 4?
One, I think this is a year probably. There was so much attention on college basketball this year, which is good. you know, the last few years. I mean, you've covered the draft. Sometimes it can be a little hard to get the fans interested because they didn't get a chance to see the players. But I think for Noah, he could, maybe there's a team that likes him. I mean, obviously, I think this class is pretty strong. But I think a team could really be intrigued by the fact that this guy's productive. He was 17 years old half the season, and he still has a lot of holes in his game. Like, he still needs to improve as a shooter, not the best creator. So you can look at it two ways. And I look at it like, if we can just add that to his game, then we really have something special.
Where do you have him ranked, James?
I got him going 9 to Toronto right now. And I know Toronto.
Personal board? What about your personal board?
Personal board, I've had him at 9.
Where would you put him?
I've had him in the top 10 throughout this whole time. Like I said, I was sold on him in Dubai. I liked what I saw from him at Basketball Outdoors last year. And then just the production is just always there. He's always getting fouled. He's always trying to dunk on somebody. And he's like 190 pounds. And like that level of like toughness. I know that league isn't, you know, it's a good league. But for him to be that productive at 17, I know, Kevin, you laughing because they got you. But
I know all about that team and that league and those orange jerseys. I know all about
Let me give you your props, man, because you laugh that off every single time. I know some people would be like, I don't want to talk about it, or they dance around it. Like, if you're not making mistakes as an evaluator, it's not even your fault half the time. Like,
hey, I was with you. I was all on the Killian train. And ironically, they have the same agent. Senge and Killian Hayes.
Like I said, I got PTSD from every angle with this whole thing. But I have to realize it's like dating. It's like, just because you dated this type of girl before doesn't mean the next one's not going to be like that. It's great. Well, with Asenge, he's a different person.
Yeah.
Different position.
Right.
There's a lot of differences. You can look past the orange jersey and the jersey and the league he's playing for. You can look past all of those things. I'm trying. I'm doing my best with him. It's more of a thing with Ben Saraf. With Saraf, it's like there's some of the questions with him with the jumper and all that, like there was with Killian. But I love Asenge. I think he's a, you know, top 10-ish prospect for sure this year. And maybe he ends up way higher in redrafts in the years to come. When it comes to international prospects, Rafael, you tweeted out this week, Nolan Traore should be back in the top 10. Why is that? What did you see from him to close the season after he kind of fell off early on?
Well, I think that if the roles are reversed, and if you put Yegor Demon or Kasparis Jakachonis, even Jeremiah Fears, if they played in the French League, a professional league, I think they would have had the same struggles early in the season also. And I think if you put Traore in a college setting, I think he would have shined. And I had tweeted, this is the same guy that scored 45 against Barcelona in the Adidas Next Generation Tournament. Jakachonis was on the floor for that game. Same guy that led the FIBA Eurobasket in assists that 9 a game. Same guy that had 18 points in the Nike Hoop Summit in 2024. So he just had a rough patch. Yes, I get that he's very one-hand dominant. The jump shot's a little streaky. But I think he's still the same player. Just had a rough patch. And he's just hasn't been able to recover, at least on draft boards, from the slow start.
James, do you feel the same?
Similar. I wouldn't put him back in my top 10. I think, like you said, he's a one-hand bandit for sure. And it's almost predictable. He's going left, he's shooting jumper. He's going right, he's getting to the basket. But he did shoot 55. He is shooting 55% at the rim. And like you said, the jump shot, really it's the off-the-dribble stuff that kills him. But, I mean, overall, I think he's at like 29% on all jumpers. But unguarded, he's at 47%. So I think that there is a happy medium there. I just think that with him, I think the assist numbers, correct me if I'm wrong, could be there's an asterisk around it because of the FIBA rules. And I do think that his playmaking it's okay. There are signs where he does make a lot of really good reads, but then there's also times that there are predetermined reads. But again, that could come along with just the age factor. But you know, if I'm Brooklyn and I don't move up to get Fears and he's there with that later pick, then I'm taking him. If I'm Miami at, I believe it was a 19 or 20, I'm taking him. I think he's a top 20 pick.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm more with you there, James. Like, I think he's a top 20 guy. Again,
I'm taking him 10.
Maybe I'm maybe it's the French point guard thing where I'm going too far the other way now. I got PTSD everywhere because of Killian, man.
I've been getting that a lot. Like, I honestly, I have him at 10. Like, okay. I think, yes, like I said, if he played college basketball, I think we would rate him a lot higher.
Sure.
And then when I look at Yegor and Jakachonis, I like both of those guys. They're obviously bigger, but Nolan measured well. 6'3", 6'8", wingspan. But one of the things I really value in point guards is, can you consistently get 2 feet in the paint? And I think Troyori can get 2 feet in the paint a lot better than those guys. So I'm kind of on my own on an island here, but I have him in my top 10 right now.
He reminds me of DeJounte Murray, like where you had questions about shooting about Murray out of college, but like the blazing speed, the athleticism, the ability to get 2 feet in the paint, as you said, eventually the shot came along. And Troyori did show some flashes. He got better in the second half as a shooter. So with him, maybe he ends up being one of those guys that somebody believes in, or maybe he falls and ends up in redrafts years from now. We have him closer to the top 10 where you currently have him, Rafael. Last thing I want to talk about is sleepers, because this week on Yahoo, I published 7 sleepers to watch who have potential to be late steals, kind of tying it to the finals, because a lot of late first, a lot of second round picks, undrafted guys on both of these teams, Lu Dort, Kenrich Williams, Caruso, McConnell, and you know, Nembhard was the 31st pick, a lot of late first, early seconds. And Rafael, you said you're also looking at sleepers this week, kind of for the same reasons. Like, it's, you know, there's so many of them in the finals. Who comes to mind first as a second round guy or an undrafted guy that you think has the qualities to be one of these rotation guys someday in a future finals?
Well, one, I had to like delete my article after I saw yours, because it was very very similar. Like, it was very similar.
Which, and
I
names had a, did we have the same? Well, on my
the
list.
One that stands out the most to me was Hunter Salas. I thought Salas was a first round pick last year. I would have definitely taken him in the first round. Went back to school and ended up shooting below 30% from three. And so that one year where he shot 40 in his first year at Wake Forest looked like an outlier year. But I thought he had some good moments at the combine. And he's a guy that I think that, I don't even know what his range is right now. I mean, somebody could like him in the 30s and it could be in the 50s. But I do think that he can come in and help a team in a scaled down role where he's not expected to carry an offense.
I'm betting on the jumper with him, man. Like, he made over 50% of his mid-range jumpers in college. Like, he didn't shoot well from three, like low 30s. But he's like an 80% guy from the line. He's an elite touch guy from the mid-range area. I think that touch is going to kind of manifest at some point for him in the NBA from 3-point range. Don't delete your article, though. Post it. It was sleepers. It's not a unique idea.
We think a lot, and I mean, dating back to the Killian thing, and so it's like, you beat me to it. I was like, all right, I gotta reframe
push,
it. So
push publish. You don't have to reframe anything.
It's gone now. So now I'm like, all right, who's the next Tumani Kamara? So that's what I'm looking for now. And so I kind of rephrased it, but I thought the Hunter Salas that you wrote about was spot on.
James, who comes to mind for you?
I like Jameer Watkins out of Florida State.
Oh, I like that.
One of my favorite players. I tell Ralph all the time, my favorite role player in the NBA is Najee Marshall. I feel like you put Najee Marshall on the court, he's just a basketball player. He played point guard for them. He played, he's 3-and-D, fought Jimmy Butler last year in New Orleans. Like, he's one of those guys. I like Jameer Watkins. I think that the statistical profile that he had at Florida State last year was very similar to Najee Marshall's last year at Xavier. I think he is just a basketball player. The jump shot numbers, you would want to be better. But, like, we saw him at the combine. He was guarding Javon Small full court. And he ripped him a couple of times. He can pass. He can score. He's got the physical frame. I just think that he's somebody that if a team likes him and he just makes enough corner threes, he can do everything else at a really high level. And he's an older guy, and he should be able to contribute right away.
Let's go through my list real quick. Give me a agree or disagree for each of these names. Drake Powell.
Degree as far as like him being a second round, because I think somebody
as a steal.
Oh yeah, definitely he's still. Okay. He was the guy that I had as a top. I think I had him as a top 15 player coming into the year. Just not a good situation for him in North Carolina. Right, definitely James? Steal.
I agree. It's very similar to Ralph. I thought he was going to be a lot better in North Carolina. He stuck him in the corner and he had to play the four. I think he has more. He's one of those guys that I feel like he has more offensive game than what he did get to show. And I think that, I mean, you can almost make the argument if his defensive counting stats were a little bit better, he'd be in the same conversation as a Carter Bryant.
maybe he should be even without him. Ryan Nemhard, 22-year-old senior point guard out of Gonzaga. Rafael, agree or disagree? Sleeper.
Agree 100%. I was in my new article that I'm going to write. It's about guys that I believe.
Just publish on what you got.
The first one is gone. It's gone. As far as like guys that I think are going to stick, I mean, I'm having a tough time ranking him because I think he's going to be a guy that's going to stick and play 5 to 7 years. With that being said, that means he's a top 20 pick, right? I don't know if I would take him in a top 20, but if I think he's going to stick every draft, I mean, I just saw that there's like been 7 guys in the 2022 draft that have, I mean, they're in trouble. Like their careers are in trouble. So with that being said, I think Nemhard is going to be a steal, and I think he's going to be in the NBA for a long time.
All right, let's rapid fire through these. You agree or disagree? One word answer on Kobe Bryant, James.
Disagree.
Yeah.
Raf?
Agree.
Okay. Too much shooting. I think he's going to at least earn minutes. Elijah Martin, 23-year-old senior wing out of Florida. Agree or disagree, Rafael?
Agree.
James?
Agree.
Chaz Lanier, 23-year-old senior guard slash wing, you know, 40% guy from three at Tennessee this past season, 6'4". Agree or disagree?
Agree. Similar to Brea. Agree. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why do you believe in Lanier but not Brea, James?
I think Brea struggles on defense. I saw Cooper Flagg. Cooper Flagg hone in on him. Huh? He is light, yeah, Flagg, but I mean, though. It's Cooper Flagg, but like, I don't know, man. 17-year-old honing in on me game like 2 of the season. I don't think that's a good sign. Now, again, the shooting is great. That's not what it is, mm-hmm. but I think defense is going to be a challenge for him.
And last one on my list, Hanson Yang, almost 20-year-old center, Chinese center, 7'1" out of China. Agree or disagree?
You're asking the wrong people about Hanson Yang. I think we've been the leader of the Hanson Yang mm-hmm. fan club for quite
a
Yangster,
while. Man. I'm through.
All in on Hanson.
For a reason.
If I'm the Nets, I'm not leaving the first round without Hanson Yang. So I agree.
Much better the second day of the combine. Like, and he had no point guard on his team. Like, if he had a point guard, he probably dominates day two, but he moved better in space. You saw the passing. He was hitting jumpers. Like Rob said, if that's Brooklyn, you got to take him.
Especially with all the picks they have.
You have to.
Yeah.
Why would you not swing on him at that pick in the first round? It would be, I think it would be like malpractice if they don't. 7'1" with that skill level. Like, you guys were both way ahead on him in terms of like where you had him ranked, your evaluation of him, and what he did in Chicago at the combine. Like you said, his day two game. Everything was just better than day one. And with him, the playmaking skill at 7'1", I don't know, man. Like, that's so important to have these. Like, the reason why I had him on that list is, like who would be the Isaiah Hartenstein in this year's draft class? Is a second-round guy, skilled big, who can pass the ball. He doesn't need to shoot. Hartenstein, like, people forget, like, kind of shot threes when he was a prospect. He doesn't do it any longer, but – like with Yang, even without the jumper, he has the perimeter skill to play make and put the ball on the floor once or twice if necessary, make bounce passes inside, execute plays. He's just got a lot of skill, man. Got a lot. Yeah. He won me a lot. Won me over a lot that week in Chicago.
And he's not won a me gentle over giant.
He was making Alex Sarr's life hell in that under 17s or under 18s, and that's the number two pick. And Alex Sarr has all the defensive upside in the world, and Yang was trying to cave his chest.
Rafael, why is Yang not like a top 15, top 20 guys? Is it just the mystery of like him playing in China?
I think so. I think it's one of those things where you, like when you think of Chinese players, obviously you think of Yao, but a lot of people think of Yi, Jiliang Yi, and the fake story that everybody claims that they saw the video of him playing the chairs and there's no video of it. There's no video of it. And so I just think that
we could generate on Google VO now. We could probably generate a video of it.
Yeah. I had a friend tell me he saw the video. I said, "Are you sure?" It doesn't exist. But I just think that one, people didn't watch him. They didn't see him. And if they did, they saw him probably struggle a little bit at Summer League last year, where just the pace of the game was a little fast for him. But he's a guy that I've just really, really liked. And I just think he's being doubted a lot just because people don't really respect the CBA and the level of competition.
Rafael James, appreciate you guys joining me. Where can we find your stuff?
Yeah, NBABigBoard.com. That is my newsletter website. And then Locked On NBA Big Board. That's where we do our podcast at least 5 days a week. So we're pretty easy to find.
Appreciate you guys. Thanks for joining me.
No problem. Anytime. Thank you.
Big thank you to James and Rafael Barlow for joining me to talk draft. Thanks to Tom Haverstraw for talking game one of the NBA Finals. We'll be back again on Sunday night after game two. Once again, talking about the NBA Finals. We'll be back then. Thanks to Mike and Amy for producing us. We'll be back again Sunday. Have a good weekend, everybody.